Victor Burton, that optimism man, and welcome to the Optimism Man podcast. And today I'm delighted to have Brad Rouswell as my guest. Brad is the Shadow Treasurer in the Parliament of Victoria, and in the Westminster system, it means he's the commentator on Treasury matters for the minority parties, and should they win the next election, he will become the Treasurer. He is the Member of Parliament for Sandringham, which is a beautiful bayside suburb in Melbourne. Well, Brad, welcome to the Centre for Optimism. And as you know, the first question we always ask our guests is, what makes you optimistic? Is your optimism shaped by your life experience, your faith, or the people around you?
A bit of all of that, to be honest, Victor, and great to be joining you. I feel just entirely optimistic just being in your presence and being able to have a chat to you, actually. Your sense of energy and engagement is quite infectious, mate. So thank you so much for the work you're doing. Look, for my part, my optimism really stems from the fact that we share a common humanity. You know, we breathe the same air. We swim in the same sea. We're brothers and sisters. And no matter your political divide or your political persuasion, we share a common humanity. And I'd like to think that the vast majority of people actually want to do better and aspire to do better, are optimistic about the future. And, whatever divides us, more things unite us. And long may that continue.
Oh, brilliantly put. So not everyone who's listening into this podcast, you know, knows your life story, Brad. Do you want to share a little bit of your life story and how it's influenced that optimistic outlook about the common values of humanity?
Sure. Look, for me, I was first elected in 2018. After that election win, my only other option was to be optimistic, frankly, Victor, because I won the seat of Sandringham on a 0.1% margin. So the only way was up after then. And in 2022, we increased that margin by about 5%. But prior to that, and I think what you're alluding to is my former faith journey. I was studying to be a Catholic priest for 2.5 years there, and I do subscribe to the Catholic faith. I think for me, there is a great the teachings of religions teach us many, many things. They teach us not just how to live and how to operate in a world, but they encourage us to be the very best people that we can be. But they also put lives in perspective as well. So for me and for other faithful people, whatever my success is, it's not about me or for me necessarily. It's how can I do and be my best to serve other people around me? And that is, for me, one of the things that actually attracted me to politics in the first place. It's, I could have, frankly, an easier life doing a whole bunch of other things. And I've come from the private sector and I was earning more money and I spent more time with my family. But it's that servant leadership, which I guess is founded in my faith and I think is best understood in a faith context, that does drive me and sustain me to do what I do. And I'm actually quite proud of that.
One of our advisory board members is James Strock from San Diego, who runs the Serve to Lead group. So I'm very familiar with this notion of the servant leader. But coming to faith, I mean, whenever I give a presentation, I often refer to the origins of optimism as Mother Julian of Norwich, who survived the Black Plague and famously wrote in the oldest surviving book by a woman in English, "All shall be well, all shall be well, all manner of things shall be well." So that notion that you can be in crisis, that in pandemic, but keep going and persist. And as you're a Catholic, I know Pope Benedict wrote a marvellous sermon lauding the teachings of Mother Julian. My other great faith leader on optimism is, of course, the Dalai Lama, who says, choose optimism, it feels better.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's very true. And from a Christian perspective as well, there is something which I think the Christian religion has perhaps as a slight advantage to other religions, and that's hope. It's so there's the time spent here on earth and the contribution that one makes here, but as a Christian, your purpose and your meaning of life isn't solely for this world. It's to prepare yourself for the next world, and so you know that's expressed through the rite of Christian burial and other sacraments, certainly in the Catholic faith, and that hopefulness I think is entirely linked with optimism.
Oh God, we could talk about this for hours. I've actually
I'd love to at some point. I certainly was expecting to talk about this today, Vic.
Christian optimism and we've written about Hindu optimism and the like, and it really is one of those features. We it's certainly all the science says that faith is a very powerful underpinning for optimism. You know, that, you know, if you go back to the Jewish psychotherapist Viktor Frankl, A Man's Search for Meaning, you know, that notion, whether you're in a concentration camp or living, you know, somewhere as beautiful as Sandringham, do your best in whatever the circumstances.
And you know, you've got on the Zoomer on at the minute for the purpose of recording this podcast, you've got this beautiful scene behind you of the sunset somewhere in the world. You might be able to explain it to us, Victor. But, you know, I think there are little things that can be done every day to increase our opportunity to live more optimistic and really happier lives. And, you know, in my electorate, one of the things that I get to do around Christmas time each year is to attend a number of local events. And, you know, whether it's a little speech that people ask me to give, or I almost see it as like a mini sermon, to be frank. And I try and pull out, you know, a meaning of life that I think will resonate with my audience. And last year, it was about gratitude. So we all live busy lives. We all live busy lives. We'd love there to be 26 hours in a day. Unfortunately, there's not. But in the moments that you're in, no matter who you're with or where you are, take a moment just to pause and to reflect and to be grateful, to express gratitude for whether it's the sunrise or the sunset or the act of kindness that you see before you, or the opportunity to have a decent meal when there are so many people in the world who don't have that opportunity. That just that purposeful pausing for self-reflection throughout the day of, you know, and I'm thankful for this, I'm grateful for this. I think it really does provide that basis for a joyful, a hopeful, an optimistic outlook on life. And, you know, as I'm saying this, you know, I'm perhaps my own worst critic. I'm self-reflecting as well and thinking I could be doing this a hell of a lot more myself.
The science says that's really powerful, as you know. I mean, you know, the notion of the three blessings in the evening, you know, where you write down the three best things. And then the trick is not to listen to the news burst up, but to actually read back what you wrote last night. And for most people, that's more powerful than antidepressants or the like. It's a really powerful technique. But you got me very excited about Christian optimism. I want to share one thing. Saint Jose Maria Escriva wrote this: Christian optimism is not a sugary optimism, nor is it a mere human confidence that everything will turn out all right. It is an optimism that sinks its roots into an awareness of our freedom and the sure knowledge of the power of grace. I just love that. That's the top of the Center for Optimism. That's the top of our page on Christian optimism, followed by the Archbishop of Lagos, who says, let's start each day with prayerful optimism.
It just helps to situate yourself, you know, in your own life, in your own place, in your own community, in our world. And just those moments of self-reflection and gratitude are absolutely marvellous. And I promise to do more of it tomorrow.
You can do it tonight. So your role is shadow treasurer. And in the introduction, I've explained to people what that is. So as the shadow treasurer and potentially the next treasurer, what drives your passion for a role that most people think is an accountant of sorts?
Well, I married an accountant, Victor. I'm not an accountant myself. And you know, I didn't get involved in politics to bean count. That's not me as a person. I got involved in politics because I should give a stuff about people. You know, I give a stuff about communities, and you know, I have a genuine love and affection for the community that I have the great privilege of representing in Victoria's Parliament. And you know, as Shadow Treasurer, I have the great privilege of visiting colleagues quite literally around the state, whether it be in regional communities or outer suburban communities, metropolitan communities, and getting to spend time with people. And frankly, if you're not energised by people and you're in politics, it's probably not the best thing for you to be doing. I do crash at the end of the end of the day, though. I mean, let's be frank, with the energy that's expected of you during the course of the day, pardon me, you can do nothing but crash at the end of the day. Look, it's a wonderful opportunity to serve, and it's a wonderful opportunity to give for others. And no, I'm not an accountant, but the economy does matter. Of course it matters. And we can see that people's outlook on life and their perspective on things can be deeply impacted by their financial circumstance. Now, it's interesting, isn't it? Because in this world, in this country, those who don't have much are subjected to or could or may be subjected to other things. Now, that could be, you know, other vulnerabilities, whether it be, you know, domestic violence, whether it could be, you know, crime, whether it could be social isolation, all those sorts of things. And yet, having travelled in other parts of the world, some of the poorest of the poor, and in other parts of the world, are some of the happiest people I think I've ever met. So it's just interesting, just this interconnectedness between one's social status and one's wealth. And I'm speaking about monetary wealth. It's not the only form of wealth, of course. And one's, you know, outlook on life and optimism rating, if you like. I do think that having a strong and stable economy, having lower taxes and having more money in your back pocket, certainly in a Victorian and Australian sense, does give you reason to be more optimistic about the future, because you have greater freedom to do what you want to do with money that you've earned. I think that's a basic principle. But wealth isn't always about monetary wealth, and wealth can't always be about monetary wealth. You know, in my own circumstance, I'm married to Kate. We have two young children, a four-year-old and a seven-year-old. Victor, can I tell you, I know it's going to happen at some point. I know it's going to happen at some point, but my day just wouldn't be the same if my kids didn't put their arm around me and give Daddy a big squeeze. You know, that actually, that makes a world of difference to me in my life. And I know for many other people, just that connectedness with their family and that physical connection with their kids and just that embrace makes a world of difference to them. So, no, you're right, mate. I'm not an accountant, but I am someone who does care deeply about other people, and that's what sustains me in this line of work.
And the Treasurer's role in Westminster parliaments and Westminster governments is so powerful. So what makes you, I mean, you've travelled all of Victoria, you know it from your own beautiful electorate, you know, which is pretty affluent and beautifully placed, you know, through to the parts of country Victoria, which are, you know, maybe in the decline because freeways have bypassed towns or the changing nature of the rural environment, you know, the bigger farms and the like. So what makes you optimistic for Victoria's future, especially considering, you know, the current challenges of rapid population growth and high inflation?
Well, I think our challenges in more recent times started around the COVID times. And I think that there are some industries in Victoria which are still recovering from that, quite frankly, and the tourism industry is one of those. Certainly the hospitality industry is another one of those. I think there's much uncertainty around future energy sources, and so those high energy using industries are still being impacted by those. But I think what separates Victoria from other parts of the world is our people. You know, there are people who will put their hand into their back pocket, and they might not have much, but they're prepared to give that to someone else for the sake of someone else having a go or having a crack. You know, there are business owners right around the state who, you know, if you just looked at the sums and just looked at the books, perhaps should have closed up shop some time ago, but continue to push and push and push because they know that if they do that, they're not just potentially creating an opportunity and a future for themselves, but they are for the people that they employ, and they are for the people, their employees' families and their extended families, that, and the general economy in a particular community. So I think there is a stoicism in Victoria, which gives me great optimism for the future.
Yeah.
Although things aren't always, you know, rosy, and they look, let's be frank, let's call this out for what it is. They aren't at the minute. They certainly aren't at the minute. You know, we've got high taxes, we've got high inflation, we've got high unemployment. You know, these aren't great things, but that's the reality of the circumstance. Now, you know, perhaps in a bit of a cheeky way, Victor, one of the things that keeps me going is that, you know, the current colour of the current government, we've got fixed terms in Victoria. November 2026 is when the next election is. I say to Victorian businesses, I say to Victorians, whatever you're going through at the minute, it won't always be like this. It can't always be like this. You know, I want to be, as the state's alternative treasurer, I want to be rolling out more red carpet and less red tape. You know, I've noted in the last few days, the government says that they want to open Victoria back up for business again. Well, you know, I first coined that phrase in my budget reply just this year to say that under a government that I was involved with, that Victoria would be open for business again. So these are, I think, the optimistic, positive signals that we do need to send, only matched by the stoicism of Victorians, which means that our future may very well be brighter. And yes, we're up against it, but I also think we're up for it.
I was recently in Traralgon, which, of course, the opposition leader comes from, and it was an event called Three Seas. It was City Country Connect, and it was half people from Traralgon and the Latrobe Valley and half business people from Melbourne. And exactly as you say, I mean, the electricity wires start in the Latrobe Valley, so they are the ones at the edge of the energy transition. And it was just fascinating to see, exactly as you've said, that people yearning for the future. So you've got kids, 5 and 7, looking out to the next 50 years. So if you're a treasurer for, say, 10 of the next 12 years or longer, how do you see Victoria looking in, say, 20, 30, 50 years? What's going to change and what's going to stay the same?
I want Victoria to be a destination where people choose to invest and want to invest. I want Victoria to be ahead of New South Wales. I want Victoria to be ahead of South Australia and ahead of Queensland. I want my children to have the opportunity to do and to be their very best, whether it be through their educational choices, whether it be through an ability to own their own home, whether it be through an opportunity to you know, study at one of our top institutions and get a highly paid job so they in turn can provide for their family and they in turn can provide the opportunities that were given to them or offered to them. This is our hope and this is our future, and it must be. You know, I think we do things so well here in Victoria, and I don't want to stifle our natural strengths. You know, industry is one of our natural strengths. Education is one of our natural strengths. Innovation is one of our natural strengths here in Victoria. And what we need in our government, and what I think Victorians should be demanding of their government, is that governments don't stifle that opportunity and stifle those industries and stifle those natural strengths, but get out of the way and encourage them. And, you know, if we can do that, if we can do that well, then I think we can do that well, then our future is bright. Our future is very bright.
As you know, I was Trade Commissioner, Victorian Commissioner to the Americas, and there is such a romance about Australia, and it doesn't matter whether you're in the United States or Canada or Mexico or down south in Brazil and Argentina, and there are big investors. As you know, both abattoirs, meat production, energy production, and they're they look to this part of the world both for leadership but places to invest. And if you can open it up to those investors to come and invest in confidence, then there's a bright future.
And I caught up with the new US Consul General just recently at a welcome reception for him, and introduced myself to Conrad. He's looking for a footy team at the moment, Victor. So I'm trying to point him in the direction of the Hawthorn Football Club, as I think that the Hawks 2025 season is going to be the one where they make the grand final. We'll wait and see. Now, when you were Trade Commissioner, actually, how did you go on convincing Americans that we call them prawns and not shrimp?
Oh, look, we held a joint barbecue with Governor Perry in Texas.
Right.
And Governor Perry, in opening the barbecue, said the Texans are the lost tribe of Australia. And so it doesn't matter where you go. I went to Indianapolis to visit Eli Lilly. The catering manager had baked lamingtons and party pies, Australian native food. The welcome mat is always there. So when you're treasurer and doing your sales pitches, and you'll have to go beyond the United States, you will have to go to Mexico, you will have to go to Brazil and the like, to be the salesman for Victoria, as your predecessors were, I think, some of whom might have even barracked for that dreadful team, Hawthorn. Now, I've caught you here. I read last year you said this: we on this side of the House will continue to do everything we can to hold the Andrews Labor government to account while offering the optimistic and propositional vision for Victoria that we deserve, one that is measured, one that is inclusive, one that is considered. We seek not to divide, but to govern for every Victorian. So offering an optimistic and propositional vision for Victoria. How have you been going on that?
So that was from my good research, Victor. Well done. That was from my first budget reply as Shadow Treasurer, offering a reply to the state's budget. Pardon me, back in the day when...
By the way, I've got the same dry cough having come back from...
Yeah, sorry, I'm just recovering.
No, everyone in Melbourne seems to have it.
Yeah, when Premier Andrews was still in charge. Look, the origin of that comment is that I think people, well, firstly, and I don't blame them, a lot of people actually don't give a stuff about politics. They don't care about it. They don't have time for it. They see politicians as those people who bicker and put punters last. And so, I mean, the origin of that comment is to say, I recognise that. I see that. You know, I mean, in my own family, you know, we've got, as we were saying before, a four-year-old and a seven-year-old. We've got a mortgage. You know, Kate's flat out doing what she does for a crust. I'm flat out doing what I'm doing for a crust. At best, we're in survival mode, right? And maybe one day, a little bit, when the kids are a little bit older, we'll be moving to thriving mode as opposed to surviving mode. And that's our aspiration for the future. But I'm not sharing that with you, Victor, because I want to say that politicians are any more or less special than Victorians. I'm sharing that with you because that is a story of many, many Victorians. And there are lots of Victorians who are just trying to make ends meet, trying to do the best they possibly can for their family. They're under family pressures, they're under work pressures. And in the context of that, I don't blame Victorians for not having time for hearing what politicians have to say. And when politicians do open their mouths, they think, oh, well, you know, they're probably putting themselves first and me last. I get that. I get that. So I think what politics needs to do is it needs to change. It needs to change from being, you know, focusing on the politics of politics to actually being propositional in our approach. Now, when you're not just critiquing and you're being propositional, what you're still doing is critiquing, but in a different way. You're saying, I'm proposing this because I think they could be doing a better job in this particular area, but it's a different way of framing it. I could simply say, they're doing a bad job, they're doing a terrible job, aren't they terrible? Or I could say, what we should be doing is this. And by saying that, what I'm actually saying is, you know, I think they could be doing a better job. So I think that in our modern Victorian community, what people, what punters are more likely to listen to is not just they're bad, they're terrible, don't vote for them. It's a bit of that. But it's more, I think things could be done in a better way. I think things could be done in a different way. I'm more hopeful for the future. I'm more optimistic for the future. But what we need to do is this. And so I think if things are framed, if arguments, political arguments are framed in that way, I genuinely think it will resonate more with more Victorians and perhaps, you know, set us up a bit of electoral success in 2026.
Look, I love the statement, the optimistic and propositional vision for Victoria. Now, you've got me as a fan on that. And I love the notion of appreciative inquiry, you know, a focus on strengths rather than weaknesses. And I think you're brilliant on that. One of the things I'd like to raise with you, though, is the research is showing that optimism is crashing in Australia and generally in the Western world. I haven't figured out whether it's problem in it with the English-speaking media or the like, but it's in free fall, and GHD and others have noted this in recent studies. And the president of Singapore, Tharman, who you'd know is one of the leading economic thinkers in the world, says that this collapse of optimism in the West is the biggest public policy issue in the world. Now, the OECD, of course, based in Paris, agrees with that proposition, and they say that optimism should be explicitly taught in schools. So what do you reckon, you know, your government will be able to do to reverse that cloud of pessimism, the collapse of optimism in Australia, New Zealand, Canada?
I think, and this is probably going back to a former life. I was once a youth minister at St. Bede's College, Mentone, where I also went to school, and I got to work with a bunch of kids when I was there doing camps and retreats and reflection days and senior student leadership as well. I was studying arts teaching at Deakin University at the same time, and so I got the privileged opportunity to work in a school whilst also studying to be a teacher. And I remember there being a bit of a troublesome group of year nines. You know, year eight, year nine, year 10 is often perhaps a troublesome year, not just in single-sex boys' education, but across the board as, you know, different developmental milestones are reached as people grow up and mature. Now, I thought to myself, what's one way that we could get through to this troublesome group of year nine boys? And so I put them in a Hiace minivan and I took them to Gore Street in Brunswick. And I got them to help Mother Teresa's nuns chop and cook and serve meals at the men's house that Mother Teresa's nuns, the missionaries of charity, have in operation. Can I tell you, Victor, it changed their perspective on things. Because for once, perhaps in a long time, they weren't focused on themselves. They were focused on other people and the plight of other people. And I don't know, I think more and more people, and I hate to say this because it will come across as harsher than how I intend it, but there is a focus, and maybe it does marry up with what you're suggesting and the research suggests as well, but I think in more recent times there is a greater sense, a greater focus on self rather than others. And perhaps that's the key. Perhaps the key is to consider your own circumstance in light of others' circumstance. And you know, to borrow that great phrase from John Fitzgerald Kennedy, you know, ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. You know, a great orator, a great modern orator in our times. And yes, a Democrat, but a decent one all the same. And I think he had some great things to say, and that was just one of them. So perhaps if there was more of a focus on what we could do for other people, as opposed to focusing on ourselves, perhaps we might just be a little bit better served in terms of seeing the potential of an optimistic future.
You remind me of the eulogy that Teddy Kennedy gave for his assassinated brother, Robert. And you remember in the closing words, I haven't got it in front of me, but he said, as he said many times across the country, some men see things as they are and ask why. He dreamt things that have never been and asked why not. And I just come from, you know, the small island states. No people on earth have lived as prosperously as we Australians. You know, our average, you know, lifespan now for women is almost 90, for we men in our late 80s. And, you know, we have an astonishing lifestyle. So coming back from CHOGM, which is the Commonwealth Heads of Government in Samoa, you know, and it's 53 countries and most of them much, much poorer, you know, than Australia. People who earn $2 an hour, you know, it's just completely different. And, you know, I went there to provoke optimism, because otherwise it's a very doom and gloom. Climate change is going to destroy us and we need reparations for slavery hundreds of years ago. But the communique included optimism. And if I could just read it to you, heads reaffirmed their commitment to include respect, understand, support, and strengthen the voice and agency of the youth, an integral part of the Commonwealth. And this is the line, and to restore hope and optimism in our common future. You said something like this yourself earlier as you talked about servant leadership. So restoring hope and optimism in our common future sounds like a huge task, but I think they're right. The Dalai Lama says they're right. The OECD says they're right. So as a dad, as a politician, and thinking about Victoria, which has been the engine of prosperity for Australia, but for most of the last 200 years, how do we rebuild hope and optimism in our common Victorian future?
By articulating aspiration. That's my short. I mean, you know, going back to JFK again, I mean, you know, we choose to go to the moon, not because it's easy, but because it's hard. You know, so the words of politicians, by some measure, you know, words are dime a dozen, and, you know, some people believe this and lots of people won't. I mean, you look at Hawke's commitment to end poverty by, where was it, 1990 or thereabouts, and or 1990, whatever it was, and that didn't eventuate, and other outlandish things that have been said since. But, you know, I think an optimistic attitude of aspiration goes a long way to setting the tone in a community, goes a long way to setting the culture in a community. And, you know, I want Victoria to have the most competitive tax regime in the state. I don't want us to be the highest tax state in the country. And I said that as recently as a press conference earlier today. You know, my aspiration for Victoria is for us to have the most competitive taxes in the country. My aspiration for Victoria is that Victoria is open for business again, that we are a place and a state that attracts investment, that is an investment destination. And I think, now does that cost me anything to say that? Look, it may in the future in terms of dollars and cents, in terms of, you know, business tax cuts or whatever it might be to you know, kickstart that practical application of optimism. But in the first place, it's an attitude change and it's a language change. And that, you know, that there should be more of it. There should be more of it.
I think, and you know, going back to those days when I was commissioner and we would have delegations, including the premier, you know, or the treasurer and the like, so much of it is in fact the sales pitch. It's the elevator pitch. I mean, you've got to go there with the right documents and show people there's places to build and there's business and they can get enough staff. So when you read the Victorian newspapers, you would think we were up against scarcity of energy, scarcity of water, scarcity of land, planning impediments. And so, you know, they get the newspaper clippings too. So it's really important that leaders like you are there shaking hands with the big investors in Brazil and the United States, and of course, up and down Collins Street too, because there's trillions of dollars in our pension funds that are there that should be able to be spent on investment in Victoria. I won't keep you for too long because you're a busy man.
Sure.
I wanted to share this with you though. Last week, the University of Sydney Business School published a report called The Optimism Effect. So they crunched 20 years of OECD data and concluded that optimism is the key to country and company productivity and innovation and capital accumulation. So in other words, optimism is a comparative advantage. So when Stone was the head of the Victorian Chamber, he always used to say that Victorian small business is more optimistic than that of the rest of the country. Now, I'm not sure that that's true anymore, but I reckon if you could harness that optimism, I mean, anyone who starts a small business starts with optimism. They believe they're going to have a business, they're going to believe they're going to make a profit. So do you reckon as the treasurer, walking, whether it's the streets of Canaiva or Geelong or Warrnambool or Echuca or Benalla, Bairnsdale, or dare I say it, the beautiful streets of Sandringham, do you reckon you can harness that optimism of small business to restore that competitive position of Victoria?
Well, we have to. We have to. We're in a situation now where you're right to point out, and let's be realistic about this, costs are going up for businesses right around the place, whether it be wage costs, whether it be the costs of services or products or, you know, product inputs or whatever it might be, rents are going up, power's going up, all those sorts of things. So, yes, but we also need to recognise the current circumstance. Now, you know, I'd like to think that I could offer some hope and potentially optimism by indicating that what I've already said, and that is that, you know, we have an aspiration to be the lowest tax state in the nation. We're you know, relying upon businesses to be the engine room of the economy that we know that they can be. And, you know, it doesn't necessarily need to be a massive business tax cut, but it might just be, you know, a red tape reduction here or a repeal of a unwanted piece of legislation or unnecessary piece of legislation over there. They can actually free up investment, inject investor confidence, and you know, get things moving again. And, you know, I guess that's one of the most exciting parts of this job is that, you know, I have an opportunity to speak to quite literally thousands of people, not just people in small business, but people in medium business, people in larger business. Just in the last couple of weeks, I've caught up with the Consul Generals of Japan, of Indonesia, of America, of the United Kingdom, of Malaysia. You know, some countries that are continuing to invest in Victoria, in Victorian product, in Victorian people, in Victorian industry. And the reason I'm doing that is because I, as a state's alternative treasurer, I want to encourage them. I want to say, you know, under a government that we lead, we want you to continue investing. We want you to not just invest what you're currently investing, but we want you to invest more. You know, later this year, in the first week of December, I'll head to the United Kingdom. I'm hoping to take a few Victorian businesses with me to introduce them to other UK businesses so that that conversation can be started now. In politics, as you would know, Victor, 2 years isn't a long time at all. And as a state's alternative treasurer, again, I have a choice. Do I simply critique what the government is doing or isn't doing, or do I provide that alternative? And I'm choosing to provide that alternative. I'm choosing not to just to critique, but I'm choosing to hop in a plane with other Victorian businesses and make those introductions, which I hope from opposition will translate into, you know, meaningful trade and increased trade between Victoria and other businesses around the world. I think that's the great privileged position I'm in, and I don't take that for granted, and I'm, you know, quite humbled to have the opportunity I do.
But that's true servant leadership. You don't need to have the office in order to take that leadership role. And you'll find when you get to England and if you go across to France, I'm off to Japan in a few weeks, the romance about just eating a Victorian cherry or drinking a glass of Mornington Peninsula Pinot. You know, just our food and our booze already puts them in the right mindset. And then your jovial smile, that's the stereotype of Australians that they love, relentless optimism. You know, it's there. Look, I've got one last question, because as you know, I'm an obsessive liberal, and I still remain puzzled.
We've all got our faults, Victor.
I don't understand how we gave away the word progressive to Marxism, which is the most regressive of philosophies. But Robert Menzies, who you'd be familiar with, once said, We took the name Liberal because we were determined to be a progressive party, willing to make experiments like you're doing, in no sense reactionary. Again, coming back to your optimism, believing in the individual, their rights and their enterprise, and rejecting the socialist panacea. So as the, you know, the number two in the coalition, you know, do those principles resonate with you? And how do we make them resonate with the voters?
Well, you won't be surprised to hear me say they absolutely do resonate with me. I'm very much of the Howard School of thought when it comes to this. I think, and quite proudly, our party is the custodian of two great traditions, the conservative tradition and the liberal tradition. Now, if we were just the conservative tradition, we wouldn't get very far very often, would we? I mean, we do need the, your word, Menzies' word, the progressive element of liberalism to drive us forward and to give us that hope for the future. But in doing so, the great thing about the Liberal Party is that we're not doing so blindly. We're doing so from the foundation of a respect of in institutions, a regard for those who have gone before us. I say time and time again, I am but a custodian of the opportunity that I have today. And I stand on the shoulders of those who have gone before me. And perhaps this is my, you know, Christian belief coming through and sort of trying to remove self from the from what I see as effective leadership, efficacious leadership. It's, you know, there are many people who have done what I'm doing now before, and there'll be many people who will do in the future what I'm doing now. And I hope they do it much better than I ever could. But, you know, that is our task. Our task is to do everything we possibly can with the opportunity we have today, not for ourselves, but for other people. And, you know, that's why I'm optimistic about the future.
Well, a servant leader, progressive, positive, rooted in values, and infectiously optimistic, Brad. You've been extraordinarily generous in sharing what makes you optimistic and what should make us optimistic. I wish you all the best. Great success on your trip to the United Kingdom. We hope to hear more on that. And I'll try and do my best as I head to other parts of the world too. And I'm sure Victorians can have great confidence in you in your role as Shadow Treasurer of the Member for Sandringham and developing great policy.
Thanks so much, Victor. Keep smiling.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that conversation and you'd like to get involved either in That Optimism podcast or the Centre for Optimism or the work we do. So you can always Google our website, the Centre for Optimism or Victor Perton and Optimism, and get involved. Come and share what makes you optimistic and get involved in helping to make the community and those around you more optimistic too. Best wishes for a good day.